May it please the court, I'm Tracy Van Pelt, registration number 26483. I will argue this case on behalf of the petitioners this morning. I represent Jim Covino. 6 weeks before trial, Mr. Covino was assigned to defend a prison guard, Rod Schultz, charged with conspiring to and assaulting prison inmates. After an 8-week trial, testimony from 65 witnesses, and 3 weeks of deliberations, Mr. Schultz was convicted. Mr. Schultz is now suing Mr. Covino and Mr. Stanton for legal malpractice for failing to call a single witness, the alleged victim of the beatings. After the conviction, a different set of lawyers filed a motion for a new trial, arguing that the victim should have been called to testify, and if he had, if this one additional witness had testified, Mr. Schultz would have been acquitted. Judge Daniel rejected that contention. That issue is the heart of this legal malpractice case. Should this court give respect to Judge Daniel's detailed analysis and ruling on the issue of causation? If you give preclusive effect to Judge Daniel's ruling that Mr. Schultz would not have been acquitted even if Pedro Castillo had been called to testify, the legal malpractice case fails. The Court of Appeals, in reversing the trial court's grant of summary judgment, did not apply Colorado law, but instead turned a comment and a restatement into a bright line rule in Colorado. The Court of Appeals decision is wrong, and it should be reversed. Judge Daniel's decision deserves preclusive effect under longstanding Colorado law. All we are asking is that this court apply the elements of issue preclusion to the detailed record before it and affirm the trial court's grant of summary judgment.
Why would Judge Daniels have reached the issue of whether or not malpractice existed as a matter of Colorado law in deciding whether a new trial was warranted? Isn't the context different enough that there's not a fair opportunity to litigate the malpractice issue?
Absolutely not. The unessential element of a motion for a new trial is whether the new evidence would have resulted in an acquittal. That is an identical element to causation in a legal malpractice case. And under Rance versus Kaufman, this court has already held that that element in a Rule 35C petition is identical to a causation element in a legal malpractice case. Understand that if this case goes down to the trial court, we will retry the 8-week criminal trial in front of Judge Lemon in the Denver District Court. All 65 witnesses will be called again, and Mr. Castillo will be the sole witness added. And the issue there will be, would he be acquitted with the addition of that single witness? That's exactly what Judge Daniel decided in the motion for new trial, and that's exactly what should be given preclusive effect here.
Ms. Van Pelt, mm-hmm. I sort of have two basic questions concerning, it's really mostly in your reply brief, not your reply brief, but your reply brief. But you make the point that there are 5 elements necessary for the plaintiff to prevail, but not for the plaintiff to lose or the government to prevail. So you say that the judgment in favor of a plaintiff would have preclusive effect, but not a defendant. And I guess I don't fully understand why that makes a difference. Let me finish. Okay. I think they're all related. And the second question I have, you also argue that it's Rance is, if we affirm the Court of Appeals in some fashion, we'd be effectively overruling part of Rance. And I don't quite understand that because it seems on the finality thing, we said, yes, you can have preclusive effect, but because the issue is still pending, we're not going to rule that it is preclusive. And lastly, how and why Restatement O is not applicable.
Okay, let me address your first point. Why issue preclusion under the current the Court of Appeals decision would apply for plaintiffs and not for defendants?
Well, I understand that.
Okay.
That makes sense, but what difference does that make?
I think it illustrates the confusion and the problems created by the bright line rule of comment I, that comment I is a bad rule. What it does is it says that if the court takes the time to decide every single element in favor of the plaintiff, you get preclusive effect to all of those. But if the court takes the time, same time, to analyze all of the elements and doesn't find in favor of the plaintiff, you don't get preclusive effect.
Well, then you could say, you make the point about a static, you have to have a static judgment. I mean, so what? And so then we go to restatement O, for example.
Well,
assuming that to be true for a second.
I'm not sure that I can assume that the restatement comment.
Well, no, I mean, assume you're making the point that we shouldn't follow the old restatement, let's
okay.
put it that way.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So assuming that comment I isn't applied, why wouldn't we apply comment O?
Yeah.
A couple of reasons, and one point I would like to make out is that is not an issue that this court accepted certiorari review on, and in the opposition to the petition, the respondents actually requested that review, and this court didn't grant that. So if you're inclined to consider comment O, I would request the opportunity for supplemental briefing on that issue. But with respect to comment O, I think it's similar to the bright line rule in comment I. Colorado doesn't need a bright line rule. The elements you have for issue preclusion give all the assurances you need to decide that an issue, an element in a claim has been thoroughly litigated and resolved so that preclusion can apply. The O issue is before the Court of Appeals. They did not address that issue at all. But trial courts are instructed to decide issues broadly and to in order for meaningful appellate review to occur, to give broad decisions and decide multiple elements. Appellate courts decide issues narrowly. Comment O means preclusive effect would be based upon whatever element the appellate court decides to affirm upon. And respectfully, appellate courts can pick any element they want. They can pick any order they want. And so preclusive effect is going to end up subject to the whimsy of the Court of Appeals and what element it decides to affirm on and address. So the only element that's entitled to preclusive effect, regardless of how rigorously and thoroughly it's analyzed below under comment O, is the one the appellate court reviews. And I think that's bad policy. Colorado need a bright line rule like comment O suggests, that the elements of issue preclusion do more than take care of any concern raised by appellate review. And later courts should honor the first actual decision of a matter that's been actually litigated. I mean, here there's been a constitutionally valid conviction of Mr. Schultz. And now under comment O, what would happen if it's applied is because the Tenth Circuit addressed just the due diligence element of a motion for a new trial, the civil case is not going to give respect to the constitutionally valid conviction of Mr. Schultz. And the civil case, the civil arena, is going to retry the criminal case. And I haven't formulated the impact of that completely, but what if Mr. Schultz is found acquitted in a civil case, but he's been constitutionally convicted in his actual criminal case? What are the constitutional implications of that? And that is an important issue. That is why this court's issue preclusion tests and the elements of issue preclusion are more than enough, and bright line rules don't promote the policy basis for the doctrine of issue preclusion in the first instance.
Could I interrupt there just one
sure.
second? Part of my problem, whether we talk about comment O or not, but just the situation in which you have multiple grounds in a lower court, and then the appeal actually does go to a higher court, and the higher court resolves the matter on a different ground from the one you want to be treated as final. How are we to interpret the meaning of that? You want us to take that as, well, what the lower court said is still final.
Absolutely.
But if the higher court resolved the matter on a different issue, are we to impute anything to that with regard to what they thought about the ruling of the lower court? Or, and by contrast, does it just mean to us, should we take that to mean we can't have any confidence that that lower court ruling was treated as final and upheld and affirmed by the higher court that considered that case?
I don't think so, and I think there are two responses to that. One is that you don't need the bright line rule that comment O suggests, that the system is based upon the assumption that courts at every level do their job. And appellate courts are supposed to decide issues on narrow grounds. That shouldn't mean that the issue wasn't thoroughly and properly analyzed below by the trial court, and therefore no preclusive effect should be given. And I think looking at this case specifically, you raise a very good point. The Tenth Circuit didn't ignore the causation issue and didn't ignore the effect of Mr. Castillo's proposed testimony. They comment on it, and they say it hardly resolves the issue of whether he would have been convicted or not. And they go on and talk specifically about the inconsistencies in Mr. Castillo's testimony. And then they ultimately decide, because of the second element, we don't need to reach this third. So I don't think this court is left to wonder what the Tenth Circuit thought about that causation or the probability of acquittal element, because the Tenth Circuit does comment on it.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that. What you just said, unless I misunderstood it, it seemed to indicate that they were indicating causation would not be a final resolution of the matter, and they felt obliged to move on and decide the case on other grounds.
No, that's not. What happened in the Tenth Circuit is the Tenth Circuit analyzes a number of issues, one of which is the due diligence element, and finds against Mr. Schultz on that element. Mm-hmm. It then goes on to say Judge Daniel did address all of the other elements. He addressed the issue of would Mr. Castillo's testimony have affected the outcome. And the Tenth Circuit says Mr. Castillo's argument is that Mr. Schultz's argument is that Mr. Castillo's testimony that Mr. Schultz didn't commit any assault would have changed the outcome. And the Tenth Circuit says Mr. Castillo's testimony is hardly persuasive on that point. Mr. Castillo's testimony is all over the place. He first testifies that Mr. Schultz couldn't have beat me because he wasn't on duty that day. The point is the Tenth Circuit, in its opinion, while it doesn't decide or affirm on the issue of causation, addresses that the causation claim is very weak for Mr. Schultz, that Mr. Castillo's testimony is so inconsistent it would not have affected the outcome.
So is the effect of that argument that what you're saying is implicitly they did address causation and we should take it as they ruled on, affirmed the lower court on causation as well?
I don't think I can go that far because they declined to reach that element, and I wouldn't want to overstate what the Tenth Circuit actually did. But I think what's important here is that the first element of issue preclusion that this court has ruled in numerous cases is, was an issue actually litigated and determined? And in the Bebo construction case, if it is presented in the pleadings, if it is argued for determination and determined, then it's actually litigated. And I would submit to you that's the test you should be applying. You don't need the bright line rule of comment O, that if the appellate court affirms on only one ground, you reject all the rest for issue preclusion.
And although that's language we've used in Bebo and maybe implicitly in other lower situations, I take it from all the arguments, it seems clear that we do not have a situation in which we've actually dealt with the problem of a higher court affirming on one of alternate grounds but not the others. Is that true?
But actually, there is no case directly on point with respect to the comment O issue. I will say that both for the comment O issue and the comment I issue, which is the idea that if a lower court rules on multiple elements, none of them are given preclusive effect, which is bad policy and against Colorado case law on a number of grounds. When you look at cases like the Salida School District case that this court decided, in that case it was the offensive use of collateral estoppel, but the court said, look, the lower court didn't decide multiple issues, and so we can't let you use issue preclusion offensively because there weren't multiple issues addressed. And I think that's a situation where comment I is in direct conflict with longstanding decisions here. There is not a situation directly on point where you've addressed whether the appellate court affirms on one ground and doesn't on the others. I don't think you need that rule. The first element of issue preclusion should give this court and appellate courts all the assurance it needs whether or not issue preclusion should apply. And in the long history of case law on this point, it's a case-by-case basis. You look at what was actually raised, what was determined, and make the decision about the first element on that basis. And I think that's the rule this court should apply. And if you apply it to this case, In spades, Mr. Schultz was given the opportunity to litigate the most significant element to him, which is whether he would have been acquitted. Judge Daniel took 4 days of live testimony on this issue. He didn't accept the government's affidavit from Mr. Castillo that was obtained after Mr. Castillo was arrested for failing a drug test. He hauled everybody into court, had a four-day hearing, took evidence, took testimony after he sat through the eight-week trial and determined that that testimony would not have resulted in an acquittal. And under the Court of Appeals decision, because he decided more than one element of the motion for a new trial, none of them are permitted to preclusive effect. And under comment O in the position urged by the CTLA in its amicus brief, because the Tenth Circuit affirmed on one ground and didn't have to reach any of the others, that issue shouldn't be given a preclusive effect. That means that thoroughly well-reasoned, analyzed decisions by trial courts are meaningless unless the Court of Appeals addresses every single element. And that should not be the law in Colorado on issue preclusion.
So why do we have to reverse part of Rance? If we hold the other way.
Getting me back to your third question there.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Rance, the reason I don't think you'd have to reverse Rance, I think the current comment I Court of Appeals decision is inconsistent with Rance for a couple of reasons. In Rance, you decide that the basic issue is whether it was ripe because the appeal wasn't final. But what this court discusses is there are two elements to a Rule 35 motion. The first is whether there was constitutionally proficient performance by the lawyer, which is akin to whether the lawyer met the standard of care in a malpractice case. And second, whether that constitutionally deficient performance prejudiced the case, which is akin to a causation element in a legal malpractice case. Under comment I, if a court were to decide both elements of a Rule 35 motion in favor of the lawyer, in other words, find that the criminal defendant received both adequate representation, constitutionally adequate representation, and went on to decide that even as the defendant urges, the outcome would not have been different. Under comment I, neither one is given preclusive effect. And under Rance, the argument is that the causation element is identical to a legal malpractice case, and it would result in issue preclusion barring the legal malpractice case from proceeding if that second element is decided in a Rule 35 motion.
What about the pending appeal part of Rance?
Well, the pending appeal part simply says you don't get to apply issue preclusion on either element while an appeal is pending. So that part is not affected by the comment I decision, I don't believe, and the Court of Appeals decision here.
I guess I'm just not understanding that.
Well, let me give you an example. Mr. Schultz has a Rule 35 motion. He filed a Rule 35 motion. If Judge Daniel had ruled that he received...
You mean a 2255?
Yes, correct. Thank you. Judge Daniel had ruled that the lawyers gave him constitutionally proficient representation and that Castillo's testimony would not have affected the outcome, under the current Court of Appeals decision in this case, neither one of those issues would be entitled to preclusive effect. And I think that's contrary to Rance.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I think it's important to go review briefly Judge Daniel's ruling and the basis for his ruling. Mr. Castillo stated, after his conviction, Mr. Schultz hired a private investigator. The investigator submitted an affidavit that Mr. Castillo told him when shown a picture of Mr. Schultz that Mr. Schultz did not beat him. Mr. Castillo also stated that he believed Mr. Schultz couldn't have beat him because Mr. Schultz wasn't on duty that night when the beating occurred. As I mentioned, the government procured an affidavit from Mr. Castillo. In that affidavit, Mr. Castillo stated, "Now that I know Mr. Schultz was on duty and actually participated in my forced cell move, I can't say that he didn't participate in the assault." Judge Daniel viewed the Castillo affidavit with skepticism. And rather than decide that issue, he held a four-day evidentiary hearing and actually called Pedro Castillo and questioned him himself. He took live testimony from Mr. Castillo and his brother. And what Mr. Castillo said testified in the motion for a new trial, and this is all in the record before you, is that after being told Mr. Schultz was present on that day, I can't say whether I was assaulted by him or not. After taking this evidence, hearing from Castillo, Judge Daniel analyzed all five elements. And I think it's important, the most important element to Mr. Schultz is whether he would have been acquitted. So the other elements of whether it's impeaching or discovered after trial are elements, sure, for the motion for a new trial, but the one that has the most effect and impact on Mr. Schultz is the one that's at issue in this case. And Judge Daniel found that even if Mr. Castillo had been called to testify, Mr. Schultz would not have been acquitted. Judge Daniel indisputably took the care necessary to give all the court, this court, all the assurance it needs to apply issue preclusion. His decision
Ms. Van Pelt, in focusing so much on Judge Daniel's order and his attention to each and his discussion of each, are you suggesting that there should be somewhat of a case-by-case approach and that the outcome might be different, for example, if a court is it rules on an issue and then summarily says, I don't find the other arguments to be meritorious either?
Yes, I do think it should be a case-by-case issue. I think that's the law this court has identified in Bebo Construction, in Rance, in the Michelson case, in the Salida School District case. These blanket rules that are being proposed by the respondents, either comment O or comment I, are not necessary and are contrary to the law here. And if you apply the issues on a case-by-case basis, then we're entitled to issue preclusion indisputably based on the thoroughness of Judge Daniel's resolution of that causation element.
But according to the test that you would have us adopt or continue with, depending on how you view that, if Judge Daniel's analysis were different here, then even though the outcome was the same, you would agree that you would be in a different posture and would not be entitled to that preclusive effect.
If Judge Daniel had not addressed that element at all, I don't think I could argue that it were entitled
to. Or if he had addressed it summarily.
Beg your pardon?
If he had addressed it summarily and appeared to rely on something else.
It depends on how summarily he addressed it, which is, I think, the issue that this court repeatedly is faced with on issue preclusion cases with the first element. Was it necessarily adjudicated? And again, if you have an issue that's raised in the pleadings and determination is requested and determination occurs, then this court has said it's actually determined and issue one, element one is satisfied. So here, I think it would depend on how summarily Judge Daniel addressed that. I can certainly imagine situations where a trial court gives such short shrift to an element that issue preclusion would not be warranted under all the policy reasons, the equitable doctrines in place in the first instance. Getting back to the Court of Appeals decision, which relies on comment I, each of the policy bases for issue preclusion is essentially eviscerated by comment I. The first policy reason is to relieve the parties of the cost and vexation of multiple lawsuits. If you adopt a comment I, which has been rejected by the majority of jurisdictions now, the issue preclusion does not apply to any multi-element complex case. That certainly does not serve this court's stated public policy interest of relieving the parties of the cost and vexation of multiple lawsuits. The second policy issue is the conservation of judicial resources. Again, comment I and comment O do not serve the policy of conserving judicial resources. What you have if you adopt both of them is no issue by a matter decided by a lower court that resolves multiple issues is given preclusive effect, and any issue a court of appeals does not address because it doesn't need to is not given preclusive effect. So you're going to have trial courts deciding one element at a time so that an appellate court can review one element at a time and go back element by element by element. That certainly does not serve the purpose of conserving judicial resources, which is a public policy basis for the doctrine.
Do we have to actually accept or reject either I or O in reaching our decision in this case?
Well, I think you do, particularly with respect to I, because the Court of Appeals decision as it stands adopts comment I in this jurisdiction.
And it's a published decision and
it's a published
they
decision.
Adopt it.
Yes, it is. So I, at a minimum, this court needs to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reject the application of comment I, which holds if you rule on multiple issues, none of them are entitled to.
Because that's inconsistent with our law that says when the facts are actually litigated and resolved, that we don't need to revisit it.
Absolutely.
That issue preclusion applies.
Yes, that's right. I don't think you need to reach comment O to decide this case. That can be left for another case, a different day when it's been briefed and has been addressed by the Court of Appeals, which it wasn't here. The Court of Appeals declined to address the Tenth Circuit's treatment at all and its effect on this decision, and that's not the issue this court granted review upon, despite having been requested by the respondents that that occur. So again, if this court's inclined to address comment O, I would request that additional briefing be permitted on that.
You know, could I, I'm sorry, I just want to jump in. I've been trying to think about this comment I, and the only way I can make it make sense is if you really focus on this concept of what's necessary to a decision. And what's necessary to a decision, I guess the theory is that it wouldn't be fully litigated unless it was necessary to a conclusion. And the Tenth Circuit basically said, we can reach a conclusion, it's not necessary for us to look at these other things that Judge Daniel said, because we can reach a conclusion without that, without looking at those. And so truly what the Tenth Circuit fits very directly into the language of I. Now, your argument, I'm sure, would be, well, the lawyers necessarily had to litigate this issue, and they couldn't know what the circuit court was going to really do one way or the other, right?
That's absolutely right.
And it was just circumstance, happenstance almost, that the Tenth Circuit came along and relied on one thing and not another.
Correct.
It was necessary for Judge Daniel, I suppose, to make those alternative findings. At least he took the position that that it was necessary for him to do so.
Absolutely.
And that seems to me to be the nut of the problem is, What does necessary really mean? Is it necessary for the resolution of the case, or is it necessary for litigation? It was necessary for the parties to litigate that issue on appeal, right?
Yes, and it was litigated on appeal. And the Tenth Circuit comments on it in its brief. It just doesn't base its holding on that point. I think where the comment I adoption poses the most problem is that under comment I, none of the elements are entitled to preclusive effect if you resolve any more than one. I mean,
well, I mean that's something that I was thinking about too as you were talking, because if you look at the example under I, they do give preclusive effect. That's the one about the guy who sues for the promissory note. And they do give preclusive effect to the liability for the note, but not the finding of fraud.
Well,
on the theory that it was necessary in the subsequent lawsuit to have that determination of liability, but not necessary to have the determination of fraud.
But those illustrations, which are not the model of clarity.
No, I agree.
The if you read that, mm-hmm. the first issue relates to a suit on the installment of the note, and the second relates to the validity of the note.
I agree with you. It's yeah. Very confusing, and which is why I've focused my question really on what's necessary from, if that's going to be the linchpin. Whose necessity are we talking about?
And I don't think necessity is necessarily the linchpin. I think it is within the element one of issue preclusion, which is something actually litigated and necessarily decided. And I think what you have to look at is when you have a multi-element, not multi-issue, but a multi-element claim, each element on its own is necessary. And when the court takes the time to undertake that analysis, it should be given preclusive.
Each element is necessary when they're not alternative elements.
That's correct.
So your Strickland example, for example, each element, you'd have to rule on those in order to have a Strickland finding of 35C.
You could stop at the first element.
You could say that there's no finding, but in order to find them, according to Strickland, you'd have to find both elements.
Right.
But what Judge Daniel did that's kind of confusing is, which is what all judges do, is just say, well, alternatively, it wouldn't stand up on any of these bases.
Right.
None of which are necessary to his finding.
Because all of which were decided.
I agree. It's a conundrum, yes.
Comment I, which I think is just, is not policy that this court wants to adopt.
Okay, thank you for taking that time.
All right, I've got 11 seconds left, so if there are any other questions, I'm not sure I'll have time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Mark Kaplan, this is Julia Purchase. We appear on behalf of Rod Schultz. This is clearly a maze that the director has created, and I think there is a path out of here. And
You're talking about the drafters of the second restatement, or what?
I am, Your Honor. And Justice Hobbs, let me start with an attempt to respond to your initial question, which is, was there a fair opportunity to litigate the causation? And I would argue no, because the Tenth Circuit, as Justice Rice remarked, didn't address it. And my client didn't have an opportunity, really, to get appellate review on this issue. Now, I think that the way out of this maze is to look at each on a case-by-case basis, Justice Martinez, as you suggested, but also to look at what the purpose of I is, what the purpose of O is, what the purpose of H is, for example. Justice Rice, I think the answer to your question is it necessary to the judgment? If you look at the restatement second, 27, and all the comments, they all talk about the judgment. Is it essential to the judgment? I don't think it's essential to the litigants, to the Court of Appeals, to the Tenth Circuit. It's to the judgment. And in our case, we have a situation where there was an appeal. I think the way out of this maze is to look at when you have multiple issues, if there's an appeal. If there's not an appeal, then the question is, were those determinations essential to the judgment? And comment I and comment H help us answer that question. H deals with the dicta, and I deals with the independent bases. In our case, had there not been an appeal, and there was a determination of lack of due diligence and all the other factors that the judge you know, ruled on, then there would have been the question as to whether under comment I there is issue preclusion. That would have been a trial court issue because there wasn't an appeal. But by appealing it, we get to comment O. And I think what comment O says is we are going to recognize the policy of that is favored of having some preclusive effect to some decisions. O does say if it's determined by the Court of Appeals, you are precluded on that issue if all the other elements of issue preclusion are in effect. So what happens is that if you take, for example, Rance, there was an appeal. If there was a determination by the Court of Appeals or this court on Rance, that under comment O is given preclusive effect. And it furthers that policy. What I says is there's no appeal and there isn't that sort of second review, then don't give preclusive effect. Let a trial court rather than an appellate court give that second review and determine on a case-by-case basis whether that was an essential element of the claim. So I think the path is that if there's no appeal, you look at I or H if it's a dicta issue. And if there is an appeal, you look at O. And there is preclusive effect on, for example, in our case, the due diligence. Now, I think it was Justice Bender, you asked, well, what's the difference between preclusive effect for the plaintiff versus the defendant? And I think we have to remember that one of the elements in issue preclusion is that they were a party to the proceeding. And that isn't here because the defendants are the lawyers. The second element is the party against whom estoppel was sought was a party to or was in privity with the party to the prior proceeding. So I don't know that I would be able to collaterally or use this preclusion against the lawyers from an appeal in a criminal case. where the prosecution is the U.S. attorney, not the, the other side is not the attorneys. So I don't know that, that there's issue preclusion going for the plaintiff. What I think the question is the plaintiff loses on an issue and doesn't appeal it, then do we apply I or not as a public policy issue? I would disagree with my esteemed colleague that that you have to rule, Justice Hobbs, because I was adopted by the Court of Appeals. I think that this court has lots of options available. One is to say we're not going to decide whether I is going to be something that we go with at this point because we don't think this is an I case. And you can leave it for further determination. You can, yes, we'll have a published decision by the Court of Appeals, but as in any case, that is always subject to your review at some later time. The other weird part about this case is that because you allowed me to supplement the record, and I appreciate that, is because we need to know all the facts, and the other facts are there's still an appeal going on. There's a Tenth Circuit appeal of a 2255 denial. And so we really don't know what's going to happen. What happens is that if you affirm the summary judgment, thereby reversing this Court of Appeals, and it turns out the Tenth Circuit reverses Judge Dan.
So let's just recap all the cases that are happening. There was the criminal trial in federal court, followed by a motion for a new trial.
Yes.
Followed by an appeal to the Tenth Circuit of that.
Yes.
2255, equivalent to a 35C in federal court,
yes.
Denied, pending appeal in the Tenth Circuit.
Appeal's been filed. There's been no ruling. I'm not sure if they've been briefed.
Pending, yeah. So we don't know what's going on there, but that at least the 2255 has been denied. Meanwhile, in the state court, a legal malpractice case.
Yeah, 225 actually was filed after the legal malpractice case was decided by the Court of Appeals.
The legal malpractice case is independent. It's in state court. The other two are in federal court.
That's right.
There's nothing that happened in the 2255 that you're arguing should have preclusive effect on the legal malpractice case. At least not. It's not in front of us.
Correct. Because the
appeal is
there
within.
Was a finding. Another basically, Judge Daniel affirmed his finding on lack of due diligence. My argument, as I just mentioned, is I don't think I can use that against the attorneys. He then went ahead and said again that he doesn't think it would have made a difference to have this witness testify. What's interesting in that case is that they tried to introduce new evidence because they had other witnesses, and Judge Daniel ruled on procedural grounds that it was too late to introduce that. So there's so many ways the Tenth Circuit can rule. They can reverse on the procedural issue. They can affirm on the procedural issue, but reverse on the substantive issue. They could reverse on the substantive issue, or they can simply say that they agree with everything. I mean, we just don't know. I'm trying not to put too many ifs in here, but that's the problem with this case, is that I don't want to see a situation, and I don't think the court does, where you make a determination which ultimately is inconsistent with what the Tenth Circuit does. I think that the reply brief addresses Comedo, so I think it's properly for the court. And I really think that is what is it. You don't have to reverse Rants. That's the natural progression of Rants, I think, because what old Rants did, I think, in the context of the issues today, is said, well, we're not going to consider it a final determination until the appeal's resolved. And what Comedo says is, once it's resolved, here's how you handle that decision. If it dealt with an essential term and it affirmed, that's what you're going to deal with. If it doesn't deal with it, then you're not giving preclusive effect to that. So I don't think Rants is reversed or in any way affected by the Comedo argument. Question, which I think is very interesting, is whether Comedo I has an effect upon Rants, and my position is it does not. Because Rants involved an appeal, and as I read Comment I, the purpose of Comment I is, well, there are several purposes, but Halpern talks about them in great length. One of the purposes is to avoid unnecessary litigation, and you don't want to force people to appeal decisions which really don't make a difference.
So do you think the Court of Appeals just erred completely in even referring to Comment I?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Do you think the Court of Appeals erred in even referring to comment I? This is just simply a comment O case? Or?
I think that it was a comment O case because there was an appeal, yes. I think that you could affirm on different grounds. And that's, I guess, what I'm ultimately asking.
What about the opportunity, Mr. Kaplan, for review by the 10th Circuit on direct appeal?
There was an opportunity for
there was.
There was on that issue, certainly, because they litigated it. But I think under comment O, it wasn't determined. And therefore, we, as Justice Coates asked, what do we take from that? How do we interpret what they did or didn't do in this case? And I think that there's only one way to be sure, and that is not to take anything from it.
Well, they could make findings with respect to their appeal to the appeal of the 2255. Not findings. They could make a holding on 2255.
Absolutely.
Which could, in fact, be inconsistent with what Judge... the judge said in the district court on the motion for a new trial.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It also could be inconsistent with whatever we say if we come out first, right?
Well, it depends how you say, I guess. You know, if you come out and say, well, unless it's determined by an appellate decision, it's not given preclusive effect, then you're not going to be inconsistent because it's whatever they say is whatever they say, and you haven't prejudged it.
So, Mr. Kaplan, are you asking us to tell the Court of Appeals that they should not have relied upon comment I because these cases are in appellate posture, and number two, to not make any kind of decision pending the appeal of 2255, or to go ahead and follow comment O at this point and not worry about 2255? That seems a little bit inconsistent if it's the latter.
I am asking the court to consider this an O case and to adopt O because I think that's the right conclusion to this case and the right application of the restatement. With regard to comment I believe this court can say that if there's not an appeal, this is, you know, on a case-by-case basis, comment I is good law. And so, the majority of jurisdictions, federal and state, that have looked at comment I have adopted. Even New York has backed off of their denial. And I think it's the Beasley case from Arkansas that is a good case, which, you know, it says, well, if there's an appeal, we're going to O. If otherwise, we're going to go with I. And so I think I'm being consistent in answering your question.
Well, I guess my concern about consistency is the timing. Since we have a second appeal of a different issue, of a different action, but with the same issue now pending in the 10th Circuit.
Well, that's why I tried to make a distinction between the motion for new trial and the 2255 in my brief, because I wanted the court to be able to avoid inconsistency. Right now, what we have before us is just a motion for new trial and a determination on that issue and that motion.
But the problem would seem to me that suppose the 10th Circuit on the 2255 says we affirm the findings on quite essentially prejudice that were made in the 2255. Then what?
Well, if I may, let's assume that you take the position that comment I is you're going to adopt comment I.
No, let's assume we adopt your argument.
Yeah, okay. Let's get I out of it and just go with O.
We adopt your argument.
Let's just make it a little simpler.
Like
let's just stay with O and
stay
see
like
what
O.
Happens.
Okay. And we find right. We would write an opinion to the effect. Just like you'd like us to do.
All right. Then the 10th Circuit affirms on...
basically the causation standard. Right.
Okay. Then I have my work cut out for me in the trial court because then I have to convince the trial judge that we have an apples and oranges situation because I want to, as you know, amend my complaint to add these other witnesses. I want to argue, and this is the big difference between what Judge Daniel did and what I'm trying to do in the trial court. I'm trying to say that the defense that was presented was not a good one. There was a joint defense agreement where everybody took the position there was no beating. What I am arguing in the trial court is the attorneys should have separated themselves from the other defendants and they should have said, hey, believe this victim. He says he was beaten. He just wasn't beaten by my client. That's the guy who beat him. And instead of doing that, instead of the defense attorney separating themselves from the others and doing their work and doing their job properly, they just stuck together and said there was no beating. And that, I think, is ultimately what Judge Daniel really got upset about, and I don't blame him. Because he said, this is inconsistent to come in here and ask for a new trial or claim your attorneys were ineffective when you stood there and said there was no beating, and this guy says he was beaten. And what the attorney should have done is they should have separated themselves from the masses, and they should have done an independent job of representing their client and said, this poor guy was beaten, but boy, it wasn't by our client. He put him in the holding cell.
I thought that Schultz was charged with vicarious liability, so did it matter if he actually did the beating or not?
He was convicted of both assaulting Mr. Castillo and conspiracy to commit that assault.
So it wouldn't have affected the conspiracy claim. Wouldn't have been a defense to that.
Well, I think if he was found not to have actually done the assault, then he probably, well, my argument is that the jury, I have a reasonable chance of having a jury say he wasn't involved in a conspiracy.
I thought it was accessory as well.
I thought it was just conspiracy.
Well, I thought that's why they went for the there was no beating argument, because they had these vicarious liabilities.
Well, I suppose
charges.
It's still my burden, and if I'm allowed the opportunity to go to the jury to convince them that the conspiracy charge would not stand up as well. I mean, I suppose there's a possibility the jury can say there's enough evidence to acquit him on the beating, but not on the conspiracy. But that I haven't had a chance to even get that, you know, past summary judgment. That's the problem.
I'm just thinking about your argument that it was a malpractice not to have them separate themselves from the defense counsel the other.
One of the reasons that there's this new evidence was so important is because there was a taping, apparently, of the movement of the prisoner to a holding cell by my client and a couple other detention officers. And then there was this alleged beating in the holding cell. So the fact that the defense attorneys didn't introduce any evidence of the fact that this tape was the FBI claimed was missing. The movement to the holding cell, but there were people who had witnessed it. These were some of the additional witnesses that Judge Daniel wouldn't let in.
Would not let in?
Yeah, and the second time around.
Right, even in the hearing where he heard Mr. Castillo, he didn't allow these others.
He heard Mr. Castillo the first time.
Right.
But then on this 2255, they tried to introduce this new evidence. Granted, they did it late, but they had it. And
what?
I'm sorry?
Of the tape. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. And so my point is...
Oh, is this the tape that supposedly Schultz was instrumental in knocking over the camera or whatever?
Right,
was
exactly.
The same tape?
Exactly. So, Chief Justice, what my point is that there's a different set of facts as to taking the prisoner to the holding cell, which my client was involved in by his own admission, and the alleged beating which occurred in the holding cell where my client says he wasn't present. And Mr. Castillo's statements are inconsistent as to whether Mr. Schultz was there that day. But Judge Daniel just, you know, flat out asked him, are you saying that Schultz was not one of the persons who beat you? And he says, yes, sir. So getting back to the vicarious liability question, I think the facts are different as to whether my client was involved in moving the prisoner to the holding cell and whether that would be considered conspiracy to commit assault, or whether, you know, so I think that, I, or, you know, and if he was not involved in the beating, I think I have a reasonable opportunity to get a jury to say, well, there's no conspiracy either, because he was involved in moving him to the holding cell, but only that, if you believe him. So I don't know if that helps.
No, I'm sorry, it doesn't.
Okay.
So let's get back to the basic kind of procedural question that Justice Bender and I are concerned about.
Sure.
So we're worried about another decision by the Tenth Circuit.
Well,
which would actually this time be on point for your purposes.
Right, and ruling against me.
Yes. And ruling against you, and in that sense, inconsistent, at least different from the first Tenth Circuit opinion.
Can I just summarize what I think your answer was?
Sure.
Shorthand would be, we apply O now, you win. If the Tenth Circuit comes out and says no causation, you got problems in district court level, but we shouldn't be concerned about it. Is that in essence what you're saying?
Almost. Basically, what I'm saying is apply O, don't you know, we don't give any effect to what the 10th Circuit did. If the 10th Circuit comes out and rules against you, then that's something that the trial judge needs to consider and apply the restatement to and decide at that point in a new analysis whether I'm precluded. And it may be that I'm precluded and maybe I'm not. We have to argue that at that time. And I'll try to argue the new facts, and they'll try to argue that it's the same old stuff, and I'm out of there. It could be that the 10th Circuit says, I've considered everything, we've considered the new evidence, you lose, in which case I probably will be precluded. But that's, I don't think, a decision that we have to make, or you have to make today. So yeah, you could say, we'll see what the 10th Circuit does, and at that point the analysis is then applied. And I guess the question for today is, do you apply at that point as well? And I would say yes, and I would say that it's probably given preclusive effect if it meets the requirements of the restatement, which is that it was an essential fact. Now, one of the things I want to talk about is Rants. You made the comment, which I think is very important in Rants, that not only the legal issue, but the fact, here it is. Trial courts have to decide, and I'm talking, I don't know if I have the official page on this. Looks like it's 140. Page 140. The very end, right before 141. Trial courts will have to decide whether issue preclusion applies based on the individual issues presented for preclusion. If the actual factual or legal matter at issue in the civil proceeding is identical to one raised and decided in the criminal proceeding, issue preclusion can apply. So I think that, Justice Bender, the full answer is that if the 10th Circuit affirms or rules against me and under issue preclusion applies, under Rants, we have to ask the question at the trial level, is the actual factual or legal matter at issue identical? And I would argue the factual issues are not, but the legal issues are. And that's, I think, for the trial court to decide. And I'm sure my opponent would say they're both identical. And that's the fight we'll have. I hope that explains how I think we should get through this maze.
Is everything submitted in the 10th Circuit case now?
As far as I know.
Okay, so it could be days, it could be months, depending on what the appellate schedule is for internal decision making.
I think that's right.
Here's, I guess, what one of my concerns is that if this is an O case and not an I case, I'm concerned that, one, we maybe didn't take all of the cert questions that we should have, even though I understand your position that it was discussed in the reply brief. And two, if we're going to, as a matter of law, adopt the restatement and particularly comment O, I'm concerned that maybe we should do so on a totally complete record, even though it might be legally permissible in this case, but it would be better perhaps to do it on a totally complete record, that is the second 2255 appeal. Those are my concerns as I'm sitting here right now. What's your response to that?
I wish I understood your process as well as I could like.
I didn't understand the cert question. That's why I'm asking this question, because I don't see anything about O
right.
being asked us.
I don't see O being asked either.
O wasn't asked and you didn't appeal.
That's right.
The other side. So
right.
It's the I issue that was appealed. Now, I don't know, maybe it was done in the Court of Appeals. I don't know.
Well, I argued H, I, and O in the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals went with I. And the cert question just dealt with I.
Just did what? Doubled up?
Just dealt with I.
Okay.
I was, trying to figure out, quite frankly, the answer to your question.
I think opposing counsel said that you requested O.
I didn't bring that. I don't remember I did, actually. I'm not sure.
I don't think there was a cross.
I don't think
I'm
there
not
was.
Seeing that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember doing that. I mean, I thought about this question, one of my thoughts was, well, once I supplemented the record, I wouldn't be surprised if cert were denied for being improvidently granted because of that issue. I thought that was one procedural way out of this mess. Another thought I had was that, well, maybe you'll consider, oh, just because we're dealing with the same restatement, and it's just a different comment, and it's my belief is that a comment is simply a suggested application of the restatement. So that since Colorado's already adopted Section 27 of the restatement, and this case clearly involves that restatement, it is not necessary that cert be granted on the issue of a comment in order for the court to use that reasoning. That's, frankly, my argument.
Could I ask you a question related to that? Whether one considers the restatement to be persuasive one way or the other. At least the CTLA brief, I think, and maybe yours, I can't remember, seemed to suggest, if I'm remembering it right, that the situation with which Comeno deals, and you're arguing it's the situation we've got here, I think the CTLA brief cites history to suggest there's virtually no dispute about that. And what little dispute there may have been in California has since been abandoned. Do you have a thought on that?
I don't think it was particularly in dispute at all. I'm not aware of any decision which has not adopted O or felt that it leads down a bad path from a public policy standpoint. So I agree with CTLA's position on that. I think the question is you know, when do you apply it, not whether it's good law. You know, getting back to the question of what do you do with the Tenth Circuit, pending Tenth Circuit, I think that you can still make a ruling that just says, well, given the current posture of the case, here's what we think we should do with appellate decisions from an issue preclusion standpoint, and you can lay the groundwork for what will happen. And we'll have a blueprint so nobody has to come back up here to ask that question. Now that the Tenth Circuit has ruled, what do we do? Because you have pretty much told us, whenever you have an appellate decision, here's how you apply it from an issue preclusion standpoint. So I think that's the answer, quite frankly. I suppose you could ask for further briefing and further submittals if you want. I have no idea what's going to happen in the Tenth Circuit. And I would be speculating if I told you what I think would happen. So I won't do that. But unless you want to know, which I can't imagine you would. I'm not sure what else you can do. I mean, you know better than I. Couple other points that I wanted to address. You know, Justice Coates, I think the answer is if the Tenth Circuit didn't think it was essential, why should you? Is sort of, I think, the question as to what interpretation do you give to that. You don't know where they were leaning, but you just know that they didn't think it was essential to the judgment, which is what this restatement talks about. And Rance, I don't think there's any reason to reverse it. You can... as I said before, Rance is a case that I think is not affected by either I or O, and the reason I say I is because it was appealed. From a public policy standpoint, there's going to be a second case. If you have I, it's just going to be at a trial level. If it's appealed, it's going to be an O case. But you're always going to have that second case. I don't think there's any way to avoid that. We're not really encouraging litigation. And if you apply I, we're actually discouraging it by giving preclusive effect at least one ruling. I think the... let's see. And, you know, I suppose the public policy has to, I think, at least in this day and age, recognize that appellate resources are just as valuable as trial resources. And, you know, the whole concept of issue preclusion is to avoid another trial. Well, if that means that we encourage appeals, are we really furthering the public policy of this state to conserve all resources in the judicial department? So I would argue that that comment I saves the appellate courts from unnecessary, perhaps, frivolous appeals. If there's, are there any other questions that I could address? Thank you all very much. I appreciate your time.
I don't know if you had any time left. Looks like you have a very small amount of time. So,
maybe, that may be all I need. In response to the issue of comment O, on page 14 of the opposition to the petition for certiorari, the respondent requested that you take on the 10th Circuit and comment O decision. And now I think my time is up, so thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both of you for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will be in recess.